Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. In February, the Euromed Human Rights Monitor released a statement detailing the physical and mental health of Palestinian detainees and prisoners who were released in the most recent ceasefire exchange. Quote, Israel's release of hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and detainees who arrived in the Gaza Strip recently in exceptionally poor health illustrates its ongoing use of torture to terrorize and persecute prisoners and detainees and break their will until the very end of their detention. The effects of torture were clearly evident, with the emaciated bodies of the released individuals reflecting the severity of systematic crimes and inhumane treatment that exceed all legal and moral bounds. Euromed Monitor also noted that the atrocities occurring in the Israeli prisons are among the worst violations recorded by human rights organizations worldwide. Meanwhile, a new United Nations report concludes that Israel has carried out, quote, genocidal acts against Palestinians by systematically destroying women's healthcare facilities during the war in Gaza, and that Israeli soldiers have used sexual violence as a war strategy. Quote, Israeli authorities have destroyed in part the reproductive capacity of the Palestinians in Gaza as a group, including by imposing measures intended to prevent births, one of the categories of genocidal acts in the Rome Statute and the Genocide Convention, said the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry in the Occupied Palestinian Territory. The commission asserted that those actions, in addition to a surge in maternity deaths due to restricted access to medical supplies, amounted to the crime against humanity of extermination. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu rejected the report's findings, saying they were biased and anti-Semitic, Reuters reported. Joining us to talk about her experiences working shoulder to shoulder with physicians at the European Gaza Hospital, where some of the released Palestinians were treated after being held in Israeli torture camps, is Dr. Sarah Lalonde. Sarah is an emergency and family physician specializing in community, rural, and remote emergency medicine, with a particular focus on indigenous communities. She's worked in Guinea, Albania, Togo, and Chad, and is recognized as the provincial physician expert on human trafficking in Quebec, Canada. She just returned from Gaza, and we're so happy to have her with us today. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege and an honor.
Same. Let's talk about your work at the European Gaza Hospital. You were in Gaza during the declaration of the ceasefire period in January. What kinds of Israeli war crimes did you witness and treat while you were there?
Yeah, so I arrived in Gaza about 10 days after the day that the ceasefire was put into effect. And I worked in an emergency department, which is a tertiary care center. So it's a big trauma center. We receive trauma transfers from other hospitals, and we have many specialties. They are available to help treat those patients, such as vascular surgery and neurosurgery. So the type of patients that we were seeing were patients affected by snipers, patients shot by snipers and quadcopters. We saw patients as well who had been exposed to unexploded ordnances, if that's the right word, and they exploded, and then they had injuries because of that. And we also saw patients who were targeted by missile strikes.
And yeah, describe the daily work that you and your colleagues did. What was it like treating patients with, you know, limited resources, limited medications, limited supplies, no to little electricity? Describe a day in the life of a doctor there.
Well, the day started we met together in the morning to discuss the cases that had happened overnight. And then throughout the day, we received a variety of patients like the ones I described. So in terms of, if we go into a little bit more detail about the patients who were shot by snipers, most of them were shot in a way that demonstrated that they did not pose any danger to the people shooting them. For example, I'll tell a story of an 8-year-old boy. So there's a little 8-year-old boy, And he wanted to go home. His parents told him not to go home. But, you know, he's a little boy. He wants to go home. And he went to his home alone. And while he was there, he was targeted by snipers. And he ran away, of course. And as he ran away, they shot at him. And he came to our emergency department with multiple wounds. And he was there alone because his parents, it took them some time to get to our emergency department. So he was there alone in our emergency department. And he was really scared. You can imagine, you're an 8-year-old kid. You've just been shot. Now you're in the emergency department, lying on a bed, looking up. All these people are looking at you. You have to he had to undergo a prolonged repair of a laceration, and that was really difficult for him. And part of our role as physicians is to treat people's pain and their suffering. And of course, fear affects all of our experience of pain when we're in that situation. So that's a case that really stuck with me. And that was the difficult part of the case, to manage the patient when his mom wasn't there and to provide him with the right services in that resource limited setting. And also, there was a beautiful moment when his mom came and the look of love and joy on his face and also on his mother's face as they met for the first time after that incident. And then I got to follow up with him when he was in the ward and continue that relationship with the family. And I'm still in contact with them.
Good. Euromed Human Rights Monitor said in their report that I quoted from in the intro that along with severe weakness and exhaustion, the Euromed Monitor field team documented severe injuries among detainees and prisoners, including limb amputations and severe swelling brought on by torture. Some appeared incapable of walking without the assistance of friends, and others required immediate medical attention because their health was rapidly deteriorating. Can you talk about the specific cases of torture that you treated and what stood out for you as a physician?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I was honored to be part of the team. Just a disclaimer, I'm not Palestinian myself, but I was honored to be included as a guest as their hospital and part of their team. And our team saw the prisoners, multiple prisoner releases. And something that all the prisoners had in common was they all showed signs of neglect, malnourishment, and scabies that had not been treated for a very long time. And our team saw many things that correspond to the type of injuries that you're talking about. So we saw scars that didn't correspond to a surgery. Sometimes we imaged the patients and to check on their organs, and their organs were still there. We're not sure where the scars came from. We saw broken bones that were broken at different time moments and did not have the appropriate care to be able to heal in the right way. We saw people who had conditions that had happened during prison, like, for example, a stroke, and then they had a loss of mobility on one side of their body and it was not treated. We saw people who had not gotten their medication that they needed. We saw people who had skull fractures that were... that had healed but had not received medical attention. There were two prisoner cases that really stuck with me. One was the one that I saw on the day that I left. Actually, I went there at 5 a.m. and we met a gentleman who told us that he'd been kicked in the abdomen recently in the last 48 hours. And so we were talking to him and we were doing an ultrasound. And while he was there, he was telling us that Israeli prison officers had wrapped his penis in a metal wire, and that prevented him from being able to pee for 5 days. And then after that, he became incontinent. The other thing he told us, he also mentioned some sexual torture, but he wasn't comfortable to go into the details at that time. And the other thing that he told us was that they gave him an injection in the prison right before he left, and they told him that this injection is going to make him very, very sick, and he's going to be sick for years. And he'll have to keep visiting the doctor. So these are the type of torture that we heard about from our patients. We had another patient, he's in his 40s, and he had some kind of gastrointestinal disorder that he received treatment for before he went to prison. And then while he was in prison, he was asking for medication. It wasn't provided to him. And he told us that when he was sick, the doctor would take him into a room, and the doctor had two things. The doctor had gas, which he didn't tell us how the gas was used by the doctor. and also had a stick. And the doctor would beat him and tell him that he can't say he was sick. And then on his last day at the prison, which was the day that we met him, he was taken into a room and some kind of Israeli intelligence officers spoke with him. And they said that actually they had a bomb prepared for him. And they loved him so much that the bomb was not only for him, but for his entire family. And that that was their plan for him when he returned to Gaza to bomb his family and kill them all. And just to see the reaction of the family, like I remember the mom was there and she was wearing traditional Palestinian clothes. And there was of course, they were happy to see their family member, but there was a lot of collective suffering as well.
I mean, what goes through your mind as a healer yourself, as someone who's worked in medicine for a long time, as someone who's dedicated their life to helping people, to mitigate their suffering and their pain, to see your patients tell you these stories and describe their experiences of this kind of horrific torture, especially, carried out by people who supposedly are doctors themselves. What was your reaction to treating these kinds of injuries and hearing these stories coming from your patients?
Well, I think it's normal to be upset and shocked and horrified by these stories. I think that, and I can only imagine how that would impact me if I was a Palestinian healthcare worker. We have to understand that Palestinian healthcare workers are not experiencing the genocide on one level. They're experiencing the genocide on two levels. So they are experiencing the genocide as a lifesaver in the hospital, or in this case, hearing these stories from the Palestinian prisoners. And they're trying to prevent death and have a clear mind and have a good headspace for that. And then they're also experiencing that genocide in their own life after the shift ends in terms of great financial loss of loved ones, being displaced, trying to protect their families, which is extremely difficult in such an uncontrollable situation for them. And of course, there's a limit to which humans can detach and be able to perform at work. And everything is really intertwined. So I think that there's a huge impact of these stories on me, but more importantly, on the people experiencing them and the people that have to hear them, that hear them all the time, right?
Yeah. Sarah, you've worked in a number of places around the world where your patients have been victims of colonialism or political instability. Were you prepared for what you saw in Gaza?
That's a great question. I want to go back to your last question for a second. You were talking to me about the prisoners and, as physicians, we need to think downstream and upstream at the same time, right? We need to think about what does the person have in front of me and how can I help this individual patient? But we also need to think about why does my patient have this problem? Like, why does my patient have a skull fracture? Why does he have a stroke? And that's why, as physicians, even though we're not politically trained or this might not be politics is not our field, we need to advocate for our patients to say, how did they end up in this situation? Like, yes, we're going to help the 8-year-old boy who was shot by a sniper, but what's the underlying reason that that child was shot by a sniper? And how can we help with the bigger system of injustice that led to that one event? Yeah. So you were asking me about my reaction to seeing Gaza and to seeing the patients. Well, my reaction is a normal reaction, which is to be dumbfounded or horrified or appalled, or English doesn't really have the word for it. But I think that in terms of our reaction to that, we need to think about the reasons why that's happening and to have empathy for the people experiencing that. And, people keep asking me, many, many people from Gaza said to me, oh, what do you think of Gaza? What do you think of Gaza? And my answer to them was that the people of Gaza are strong, that they're beautiful, and that they deserve everything good. So if I wouldn't accept a condition, like I live near the trauma center in Montreal, right? So if I wouldn't accept that my colleagues who work at the trauma center down the street in Montreal would be tortured, killed, displaced, lose electricity, lose access to their money, and all the other things that Palestinians are experiencing, whether they be healthcare workers or the recipients of healthcare, then why would I accept that for anybody else?
Yeah. I think that you hit the nail right on the head there. I mean, and just the, you know, before the 15, 16 months of genocide and genocidal attacks on Gaza, there was 17 years of a blockade where the hospitals, before they were all obliterated and bombed and the directors of those hospitals were abducted and put into torture camps, the hospitals in Gaza were already running at, you know, a limited capacity, to say the least. Certain basic medications were not available to people in Gaza under the blockade that began, you know, 17 years before. You were there at the declaration of the ceasefire, as you said. How can you assess the level of medication and medical equipment that was needed and that was able, you know, to be accessed, you know, in the weeks following the ceasefire? And I'm just thinking about now, you know, we're recording on March 14th. This is now the 13th day in a row that Israel has closed the crossings to all humanitarian aid, including food and medicine and fuel and construction supplies, etc. How can you assess how your colleagues in Gaza are able to operate at this level?
Yeah, well, I think your question has two great parts. So I'll start with the supply part of it. So I think that, we observed firsthand, and my colleagues who are still there continue to observe a shortage of equipment, instruments, medication. You know, there are a lot of makeshift solutions that need to be used that are not ideal, but that we have no choice but to use. We've been reusing disposable equipment. We have a lack of mechanical ventilators. We have a lack of ways to monitor the patient. For example, we have sat probes that go on the finger, but we don't have the ones that go on the ear or the forehead. So if the patient is really sick and there's not enough blood flow to their finger for the sat monitor to work, we're not going to be able to monitor that patient's pulse and oxygen saturation. We're lacking capnography, meaning the ability to measure the carbon dioxide, which is really important during sedation, during CPR, and during other and after intubation. The tools that we are using, for example, the CT scanner, which was in disrepair and was repaired last year, has a black spot on the CT. So every CT has the same black spot on it. So the quality is not optimal. And the parts, of course, for the CT scanner are not there to be able to fix it. The MRI, which did work at one point, is completely unable to work. And then there's the whole level of analgesia. So we're lacking. When I was there, we didn't have any oral analgesia for children or adults. And in terms of anesthesia as well, we were missing quite a few things. And we were lacking a lot of things to help us monitor our patients, like the paper for the ECG machine, the blood pressure cuffs, and some of the suture packs were not meant to be used on humans, but we were using them on humans. So there's a lot of supply medication issues going on. And since the crossings have closed, there's a big impact. First of all, there are many patients that need to travel urgently to complete their medical management, and they can't do that. But also, there's no more stuff coming in. So the situation now is worse than when I was there. And then I think you were asking about as well the impact on my colleagues, right?
Yeah.
So in medicine, we're using our brain and our attention to be able to figure out what our patient has. We know that history, everything that we do in medicine is about taking a good history. And you can imagine that if you're living in a tent, you're lacking resources, you don't have access to water, you're child might not have as good access to food, and there's loud drones at night, that you might not be sleeping that well, in addition to all the mental health after effects of being a physician or a nurse during a genocide. And so your attention span might not be what it normally would be if you were well rested and in a different situation. So that's another way that the healthcare system is being destroyed. And that reminds me of one night I went to the ER, but in a more informal way, and I sat with the nurses. And the nurses started talking to me about their experiences during the genocide. They started talking. One of them told me that on the first day of the genocide, he was sitting outside drinking a coffee with his boss after a 16-hour shift. And then it was a wonderful, beautiful day. And then he came in, he understood the war would begin. He went inside and they had a mass casualty box. And in the mass casualty box, they had 10 times the amount of gloves that they would use in an 8-hour shift. And he told me that those gloves were used up in 5 or 10 minutes on the first day of the genocide. And then he explained to me how they put two patients in each bed, and they had patients all over the floor in this tiny crash room that I know very well because I spent a lot of time there. So he was talking to me about that. And they also talked about their mental health and their children's mental health, and also how they de-stress. So it was a long conversation. And then I went outside, and when I came back in, he said, there's one of the patients who wanted to tell you something. So one of the patient's family members had been there listening to this conversation with the nurse. And the patient's family member said that the healthcare workers, our healthcare workers, are our heroes. And that's what the patient's family wanted me to know about my nursing colleague who was talking to me.
I mean, as you've come back to Canada, and as you continue to recount these experiences to media or to your colleagues, what stories, images, experiences do you keep thinking about, and how has your work changed, if it has, as you've begun to unpack, your work in Gaza? How can physician, like, what is the role and responsibility of physicians who go to Gaza to work shoulder to shoulder with Palestinian doctors and nurses, in terms of activating, you know, Western medical institutions to do something about the genocide, about Israel's violence and the ongoing war crimes that are still being perpetuated, whether or not there's a formal ceasefire?
Yeah, well, my answer to the second part of the question has to do with solidarity. So I like to think of things in simple terms. And solidarity for me is about being with people in their situation of oppression. And solidarity is not solidarity unless it costs you something. It's like anything in life worth having. You know, you can't say, oh, I'm going to be a mother, I'm going to be a father, but I'm not going to make any sacrifices. It's not going to work. And I think that what our colleagues would ask from us is to show them that solidarity and be with them. And I think that in multiple disciplines, at times, people are not feeling that. Like, I spoke with a journalist while I was in Gaza, and she said that she didn't feel supported by the international journalist community. I'm not saying that's representative of everyone, but that was her individual feeling on the day that I spoke with her. So I think that solidarity is a really important, concrete solidarity is really important. And asking people, what do you want me to do for you? Not deciding what we should do for them, but to say, oh, you're in this situation, which is not a situation I'd like to be in. And how can I come alongside you? And what do you need from me? And that is a way that respects the honor, dignity, and personhood and strength of the person in front of us. Yeah. Okay. So that would be my answer to that question. When I think about stories that stick with me, I could sit here for at least 8 hours and tell you stories. I made a poster and I came up with 46 different stories or different moments. And I'll start by telling you about two of them. So the first one is a 40-something-year-old man that I saw in my first few days there. He was a really, really sick guy. He came in. He'd been shot by a sniper multiple times, and he required multiple chest tubes, intubation, multiple trips to the operating room, multiple involvement of multiple subspecialties. And I was really worried that our patient was going to die. And what made it even more real for me was that his nephew was a nurse at another location and came and was in the resuscitating room with us while we were trying to take care of the patient. And I went to go visit him quite a few times when he was staying on the ward. And when I talked to him about his story, he said to me, "Why was I targeted? Like, I'm a 40-something-year-old man. He has six kids. He has a job that has no relevance to politics or military, doesn't own a gun." Like, he was saying, "Why was I targeted? And why is it that, and is telling my story to the world going to actually accomplish anything?" And I got to meet his wife and some of his children, and he asked me to tell his story, which is why I'm sharing it with you. And there was another child that I interacted with, a 15, 16, 14-year-old, around that age boy. And there were a few boys that were together, all underage. The three of them came to our hospital, and one of them was sick and was very sick. He went to the ICU, and I went to go visit him on the ward. And despite the fact that he's underage, you could tell he was trying to be a man in the best sense of the world, in the most honorable way. So every time that we would go visit him, he would give us his most expensive possessions, which was apples, which were really expensive at the time I was there. And he was very kind to me and my translators and welcoming us to come see him every day. And also he told us that the best moment of his day is when he wakes up and he sees his mother's face. So it just helps me to keep in mind, you know, we hear stories on the news about people being hurt or dying, and each of those people is a wonderful creature that, you know, we would value so much if we had the opportunity to meet them.
Yeah, I mean, each person, you know, is someone's entire universe. And I mean, I think that's part of the, you know, part of the tactic of dehumanization of Palestinians, not just over the last, you know, year and a half, but over the last 80 years, has been trying to, you know, make their suffering normalized, make, you know, Palestinians being killed, being shot at, being disappeared, just, you know, something natural. And so I really am grateful that you have that you've come back to tell these stories, and you know, and that you're finding ways to remain and strengthen that solidarity that you've been practicing. So I really am so grateful. I know our audience is very grateful for that. What's next for you? What, where can people find your writing or images or testimonies? Tell us how people can follow you.
You can follow me on Instagram at dr.sarah.lalonde.
Wonderful. Dr. Sarah Lalonde, thank you so much for your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having me.